listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Radio Tacoma, Sound Poetry on KTAH 101.9 LP FM. And we want to wish a fond hello to a haiku aficionado today who's going to inform us so much about what we don't know about haiku. And so I would like you to feel happy to read as many haikus today as you wish. It's Carmen Sterba. I want you to welcome Carmen Sterba, who is foremost haiku artist among the Northwest Haiku Society and formerly had the position of secretary of the American Haiku Society. Is that right? Or was it the international one? You tell us about that.
I started a group in Tacoma. It's been going for about 15 years, I think. Mm-hmm.
And you meet in what venue when you do it in person?
That's King's Bookstore. We have just been reading some of our haiku, sending it to each other, but just by email. And the other group is a church group of women.
Would you like to start by reading a haiku and perhaps giving us a lesson in the various elements of it?
Independence Day, celebration in the skies. Rip-roaring thunder.
Yes, very descriptive. Very good.
Okay, and an expert, Makoto Ueda, wrote about the difference between tanka and haiku. Now, a lot of people don't know about tanka, but tanka was the first poetry in Japan, and it started just 794. It was people from the Han era, and the people who wrote tanka were in the imperial court. And at that time, there were a lot of Japanese women who were in the imperial court who wrote tanka also. Now, tanka has 5 lines. And haiku usually has 3 lines. So that's two things that are different between these two kinds of poetry. Expert Makoto Ueda wrote about the difference between tanka and haiku. Haiku depends largely on the power of images for its poetic effect, while tanka tends to be more lyrical and expressive in a wider ways. I wanted to start with tanka because this is the oldest poetry in Japan. And so I'm going to read just a couple, okay, just 3. The first one I'm reading is by Saigyo. Saigyo was a samurai who became a monk and finally a tanka writer. But he was really, really good. Okay, I'm going to read one of his tanka. In the mountain village where I've given up all hope of visitors, how drab life would be without my loneliness.
Syllables are important in tanka also.
Uh-huh, yes.
How many per line then? How does that one go?
It doesn't go by line, but how many? And it's about 32 But nowadays, everybody kind of tend to shorten the tanko or haiku. Here's another one, Masaoka Shiki. He's very famous and for both haiku and tanka, but he was bedridden in the last 5 years of his life. I chose this tanka because it shows how he feels. And you need to know that he was always not in a bed, but a futon. And he couldn't walk anymore. And he could only look out the window to see what's happening. He would watch what was happening, and he'd always find ideas for finishing his tanka. So here's one. Peacefully, the hamlet is asleep with all its lights out. The river of heaven, white above the bamboo grove. River of heaven is Milky Way. Here's one of my tanka. Married at 69, knowing we are stuck in our ways, yet we listen as we bend in the wind.
Very nice. Very, very personal one, Matt. Yes.
Yeah.
So that one is one of your tanka.
Yeah, that's one of my tanka.
Now you're going to move to the haiku and give us some terms that we might know it better by, right? Uh-huh. And the syllables are different again with what, the three lines of haiku now?
Well, yeah, most people write in three lines, but some people stretch it out in one line. Very important things in haiku are brevity, juxtaposition, imagery. Those are three of very important things. I have a little list. I have a list, but in the beginning of the list, it says, haiku is not a sentence or a list. Because I've been in groups that people didn't know anything about haiku, and they just wrote a sentence or a list. Okay, number two. As you find good ways to write haiku, you will improve. Number three, you don't need to count 17 fingers. In Japan, I often saw Japanese people count by their fingers, and I knew that the people who did that were writing haiku. And yes, people used to write in 17, but nowadays, you know, people often say, oh, 10, even 10 is all right, or even 8 is okay. So you don't need to worry about how many.
That will loosen a lot of people up to write some haikus, yes.
Okay.
Don't worry about those 17 syllables, right? Good. That's good advice.
Taking unnecessary words out of is very important to have brevity. And I think that's really good. When I was first writing haiku, I went to England, and that was very exciting. And I met a man from Amsterdam, and he wrote very, very short poems, but very, very good. And at that time, I stopped using 17 syllables. And then using juxtaposition is basic by adding something unexpected. That's often a very good thing to be prized in the last part of the haiku. And then number six, learn about imagery, insight, or renaissance in haiku. Those are some things that I got from different books and myself.
Now give us a sample of a couple of haiku and point out what you can about those aspects of it that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's right. This will be the easiest thing. Okay. And these are all my haiku. Moving day. The passenger train completes a horseshoe curve. I think the surprise here is that the person was moving and they felt that the horseshoe made them feel that they're doing the right thing, that it have something good from now on. Okay.
All right.
Next one. Voices of swimmers chime across the water. Walden at last. One mallard drifts on the satin lake. My mind smooths out. Faded freight cars, the bloated letters of fresh graffiti.
Very topical, that one. Images that many people are familiar with. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Bloated graffiti.
Flight turbulence. An open shade reveals the Big Dipper. The Quaker's silence spills out of a wide open door. Autumn woods. End of winter. A lost ball rotates below the waterfall. Leaving for home. Strands of seaweed wrap around our ankles. Well, that was in Japan. But it was true.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I was in the ocean. I lived quite close to the ocean, to the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, and so a lot of these, they come from images that you cite, and perhaps you have your paper and pad handy to note certain aspects of the image, and do you later go home and perfect the haiku, or do you work on it while you're in the very scene?
Certainly you work a lot on your haiku or tanka. It's not something that, you know, you can finish in a short time. I can remember there's a couple of haiku that I just didn't look at them anymore and waited. And maybe a couple years later, I finally made it into something better. Yeah.
Very good. So you can be very, very patient with those three lines or 17 syllables. Yes. That's good advice. That certainly is what people need to hear.
Yeah.
Take your time.
I have several of the haiku are about American Lake, and here's one of them. Water sounds. My memory wanders the coast of a summer lake. I wrote this haiku in 2003. Dazed eyes of the new prisoners of war. Their parents' eyes. Talk of war. The clean slate of the new year. Already sullied. Single living. I allow the tea kettle a full whistle.
There's that patience at work again.
I have an honor mention of the Valentine Awards for that.
So in some of the poems, I noticed there is the element of a sort of seasonal term telling maybe something about the climate or even particular word about, say, season, whether it's spring, winter, or something mm-hmm. like that. But not always.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started writing, everyone said you need a season word, and in Japanese it's called kigo. So that was kind of severe that you had to always do that. I think most of the people I write with now, we really don't think about season as much, but it is an important part. Here's another haiku that is just the right time for you to hear this. Warmer days, scent of the fresh pea pods from the stir fry.
Mm. That was a surprise.
Oh,
I thought we were going to be out in a garden with the pea pods. And then you bring in the stir fry, which puts us in a kitchen or a stove. So there is a surprise element then too.
As oh, you sure.
Out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can happen a lot. The solace of crickets at night. No way to say thanks. Okay, next two were I wrote in Japan. Temple at dusk, the sound of a monk's sandals on autumn leaves.
There you have the seasonal element in the last line. What I'd like to ask is, as you read the haiku with your company in the society, you know, in poetry readings, it's often sometimes there's a polite coffee hand clap. Sometimes there's an audible ah or a noticeable acceptance or some sort of a ritual noise, you know, to say oh, we've heard that. That was good. Or in haiku, because of the quietude, the tranquility of most of the images, although not always with whistles going off on kettles, but in some of them, you feel that it's best to just be very quiet for a while and let that one sink in. Is that the way many respond, or do people comment on how they like that one or what's good about that one? How do you do it?
I've never been in a group that we clapped. So it is softer, you know. And I notice that when we're a big group, sometimes you hear somebody saying, you know, something like that. And I do that. I do that too. When I really like a haiku, I'll go, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a very good question.
Well, I had thought about it. I thought it might be a very quiet set of readings where people perhaps had the patience, as you talked about being patient, not only with the way the haiku has come about over time, but a person shouldn't be too quick, maybe as I've been a little quick sometimes to comment here. Maybe there's no need for comment on many haiku. It's just a matter of allowing the image to be slowly digested in the thoughts, in the mental imagery.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's so good to read it slowly. I mean, do that on purpose, you know, because otherwise, what? What was that? It's gone. It's
only. Yes.
Yeah. So here's another one I wrote in Japan. It doesn't really seem like Japan, but, you know, Japan is modern and there's all kinds of things that the Japanese love. Waiting room. Stealing into the garden of a Renoir print. And I was waiting for my son to come out, and there was a calendar, a Renoir painting, and that just went together.
Well, that really did evoke coloration, because if anybody has seen a Renoir painting, the splashes of color that he exploited so much, especially if the day was beautiful too, a sunny day. Wow, the colors were vibrant. So have you done illustrated haikus sometimes with your group?
Well, there are people who will paint to write a haiku and then paint around it. That's very common. Mm-hmm. It's called haiga.
Haiga.
Haiga. Mm-hmm.
Well, some are interested to hear, I'm sure, about your experience, your life in Japan. You lived there many decades.
Yeah.
As you told me the other day. Tell us a little bit about your career there.
It was my third year of college, and I decided to go to Japan. The reason partly was that between high school and college, I was in a musical group, an international group, and it was called Up With People. And I was in that group, and I went to Japan for a whole month, and I fell in love with Japan. And when I was in Japan, I told myself, I'm going to go finish my college in Michigan. I'll go to live in Japan. And so I did that. And I think it was a wonderful thing that I was able to do that. I think it changed my whole life.
Were you in the big city in Tokyo, or did you go to other cities for your schooling?
Well, in my university, it was in Tokyo, and I don't like Tokyo. but I loved the college and the other students, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
When you settled there and taught, did you taught in a university perhaps, or a college?
Yeah, well, at first I just taught ESL in a small group, but later I started going to colleges. I usually went to two different colleges in the Yokohama area. I continued to do that. But I also got married in Japan. And my first husband was Japanese, and my three sons are half Japanese, and they're so beautiful.
And did they come back to America with you, or did they continue their careers in Japan when you came back?
Well, there was a time that we went to America for about 4 years. And then we went back to Japan. And then when my children got older, they decided where they're going to stay. And two of them decided to stay in Japan. And the other one went to America. And that was about the times that they were in college. And my son that chose to go to Philadelphia was that he had kind of a difficult time in Japan because he didn't look Japanese at all. And he has green eyes and curly hair. And he was treated badly sometimes when he was little. One thing that's really sad is though he stayed in Japan until college and when he went to a test for a Japanese college, his Japanese was perfect. When he walked in the room of the tests for getting in a college, some people said, "What are you doing here? You don't belong here."
Rejection.
Well, he had kind of a really hard time.
Very hard time, that sounds.
Yeah.
Like.
For about 2 years, he was depressed.
When he came to America then, did his life improve and his sense of self, his confidence return?
Yeah, well, in between that time, little by little, he wanted to go to, it was Temple University, and he knew some friends that went there, and so he did. And he's been very happy, I think, now in Pennsylvania. And I lived in Pennsylvania for about a year and a half, you know. And then finally he said, "Mom, this is my city."
He found his place.
Yeah. So I came back to where I grew up.
Well, very interesting, Carmen. That shows quite how much you really were in the life and aware of cultural difficulties as a foreigner. And yet you've weathered those, your family has weathered those times. The two children in Japan, are they comfortable in their careers?
Yes, they are. And my oldest son, at first for quite a few years, he did translation. And he had learned Korean, too. So he has three different languages. But later, he changed his job. He got a job, patent. And it was only Japanese.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's good that he could find something in Japan where they accepted him. They accepted him. Yeah.
So one of your sons did take after you to go into the literary angle, and another went into more commercial work in a patent office.
Yeah, my youngest son. Well, he did two different things. He became a guitarist.
He had a reputation for his, he was well known for his guitar work then.
Yeah, well, he started a group. Yeah, he was very popular. But as he got older, he decided to get another job, that he needed another job. And he is a manager in a very, very well-known department store in Shibuya, which is a very cool place.
All right. So what an interesting life you have lived, really, in two cultures, split up at times, with even your family split up, so that you've really had a great variety of worldview in both of these situations, with your Japanese children comfortable in their culture, and then another son so uncomfortable he became much more attuned to the American culture.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's very doing very well now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we finish with your leading yet another, either tanka or a haiku.
Okay. Haiku. A piercing cry. No theater actors become their masks. Now this is N-O-H. Do you know the no theater?
The no theater, yes. I'm familiar with that, and maybe others are too.
And they all dress in black.
Right. Many Japanese films have sometimes incorporated some of the no theater sounds, the strange singing sounds, so high-pitched sounds with masks or not, tainted faces.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. You choose one that has to do with masking at the end, since we too are becoming masked individuals in our own culture here, in our own society.
Oh, but I've got something from England, okay?
All right.
This is the last one, then. Sherwood Forest, under the flicker swings a flash of gold.
Well, thank you so much. We've really enjoyed hearing your verse. Very, very sensitive verse that we have to be patient to listen to and allow to settle in us. And I think you have pointed out just the importance of that in that word patience that you used earlier. The quietness, the solitude. We're in solitude, many of us today. So as people are practicing their poetry, I think you've given some encouragement, maybe some suggestions here that people might practice these lovely momentary images to capture and allow them to be not particularly frozen, still have their life, still have their warmth, as well as their chill, if it's a winter experience. But whatever the aesthetic is, whatever the sensitivity is, that we have to take the time to understand, to have it crystallize in us. Yes. Well, Carmen Sterba, haiku poet, poet of the Northwest Haiku Society, I want to thank you so much for sharing so much with us today. And I really have appreciated what you have actually informed me about. So please, it was such a pleasure. Thank you for coming to Sound Poetry.
Thank you.
This has been Sound Poetry with Carmen Sterba. I'm your host, David Gilmore. Thank you.